Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour live from the BBC World Service in London. I'm Rebecca Kesby. And we head first to the Middle East, where along with continued fighting in southern Lebanon between Israeli troops and Hezbollah fighters and another major Israeli airstrike overnight in northern Gaza, there is anticipation that Israel may be about to action its pledge to retaliate to the multiple missile strikes fired at Israel by Iran earlier this month. Later in the programme, we'll be hearing from our reporter who's been embedded with the Israeli troops in southern Lebanon. But first, let's cross live to Jerusalem to our correspondent there, Wira Davis. Wira, thanks for coming on the programme. There are a number of threads to update us on today. First, though, can you kind of give us an idea on the political mood there at the moment and these expectations that an Israeli strike of some kind may be coming on Iran? What are you hearing?
Yeah, look, the Israeli cabinet, security cabinet, will meet again tonight. Obviously, things were fairly quiet in Israel over the weekend because of the Yom Kippur religious holiday. But things have, you know, picked up again as normal now. And there's this expectation because there's been a promise from the Israeli defense minister that Israel will strike hard, lethal, in a lethal way, and Iran won't know what will have hit it, to paraphrase Mr. Gallant. So there's a full expectation here in Israel and amongst Israel's allies that there will be some sort of retaliation against Iran for that unprecedented missile attack from Iran at the start of this month. Now, the Americans are putting a lot of pressure on Israel not to attack Iranian nuclear facilities. I'm sure Israel would like to do that with American help, but Joe Biden's made it clear that he doesn't want that to happen. So we don't know what form this Israeli attack will take, but it's fully expected that it will happen. And another development on that front, which is quite important, it looks now that the Americans are considering sending a very high-spec, high-altitude missile defense system to Israel in order of an anticipated Iranian response if Israel attacks Iran. And it just goes to show how this war is in real danger of escalating to something much, much bigger. And it also shows, which is, you know, important in itself, the degree to which Israel would rely on the United States if there were to be a bigger conflict with Iran.
Certainly sounds rather tense on that front at the moment, Wira. Of course, the conflict in Lebanon goes on, and we understand there's been quite close fighting in southern Israel, both sides reporting that. And then another warning from Benjamin Netanyahu today for UN peacekeepers to leave the area.
Yeah, there are several thousand Israeli troops inside southern Lebanon. And even in the last couple of hours, there have been reports of several injuries on both sides. The Israelis have acknowledged that the scale of the force and the scale to which Hezbollah is much better equipped than Hamas is very different to what they've experienced in Gaza. And this was always the danger for the Israelis in engaging Hezbollah directly by going into Lebanon. There was a risk that it could be even more difficult for Israel than what we've seen over the last year in Gaza. Now, of course, Israel has only been inside Lebanon for a matter of days, and it'll be interesting to see how that develops. But the Israelis clearly want to push back the Hezbollah fighters deeper inside Lebanon. They say, in accordance with the UN Resolution 1701, which ended the last war in 2006, and to that end, the Israeli Prime Minister has insisted in a direct message to the UN Secretary General that the UN peacekeeping force withdraw from the front line. But the UN has again insisted that it has a job to do, despite the fact that some of its positions came under fire from Israeli troops over the last couple of days.
Of course, all of this is going on as the war and conflict in Gaza now enters its second year, and there's been more airstrikes in the north overnight and some fatalities.
Yeah, no, indeed, and Israel has acknowledged it's fighting wars now on several fronts. I mean, the Gaza war, which started over a year ago, is still continuing. Israel has stepped up its attacks in recent days around the Jabalia refugee camp in the north of Gaza, where there are an estimated 400,000 people in that region, according to aid agencies. Israel appears to be not only trying to get rid of or defeat the remnants of Hamas fighters in that area, okay, but it appears to be trying to clear the area altogether. So its military campaign can be concluded, but also maybe to create a buffer zone between Israel and Gaza.
Wira, thanks so much for joining us live on the line there from Jerusalem, the BBC's Wira Davis. Well, on the subject of that conflict in Gaza, as Wira was saying, there is suspicion among Palestinians, the UN and relief agencies that the IDF is gradually adopting some or all of a new strategy that he alluded to there in northern Gaza, known as the General's Plan. Now, at its heart is the idea that Israel can force the surrender of Hamas and its leader Yahya Sinwar by increasing the pressure on the entire population of the north of Gaza. The plan was first devised by a group of retired senior officers led by Major General Giora Island, who is a former national security advisor, and he has been speaking to NewsHour's Julian Marshall.
Hamas manages to continue and maintain their effective political control of the Gaza Strip. And it happens for the simple reason. Every day there are about 300 trucks of supply that enter Gaza. And Hamas is the main player that is delivering this supply. So it's perceived by the population as the legitimate entity, or more than that, the group that is taking care for the people. Since Hamas gets all this supply for free, but they resell it in a very exaggerated price, they become richer and richer. And the fact that they are so rich today enabled them not only to maintain the existing administrations that consist of tens of thousands of employees, but they can easily hire new combatants to replace those who have been killed because they can offer them a very nice salary. Hamas feels quite comfortable, especially the leader, Yahya Sinwar, because as long as the political control of Gaza is in his hands, and as long as the people of Gaza gets all the supply, he has no real incentive to give up anything, and especially not to give up the 100 Israeli hostages that are still in captivity.
How do you therefore defeat Hamas?
The only thing that might bother Sinwar today is a loss of land. So Israel is actually encircled. The northern part of Gaza that contains something like 35-40% of the whole area of the Gaza Strip, we do it since November. So what we have to do is actually to execute a real effective siege over this area. Now, in this area, there are about 300,000 civilians. So before we exercise a real siege and prevent any supply of goods to this area, we should give all the people who live there early warning and tell them that they have to leave in, let's say, a week or 10 days. And after that, we will stop all the supply to this area. So those combatants and other officials of Hamas that choose to stay will have to decide whether they are going to surrender or they will starve. And if it happens, and when it happens, it means that we can easily take control of all this area. Now, why it is important? Because when we take control, practically speaking, occupy all this area, we will tell Sinwar, actually we have to tell them in advance, that if there is no reasonable hostages deal, and if in few months all the hostages will be dead, then he will never see this land, and this area will be taken out of Gaza.
This is a strategy that you and former military colleagues came up with, and I wondered whether it was being implemented either in full or in part in northern Gaza by the IDF at the moment?
At the moment, I cannot see that the full plan is going to be implemented. It is true that there is a massive ground operation north of part of Gaza, and it is true that the IDF is calling to people there to leave this area, but their critical element is missing. And the critical element in our plan is a real formal announcement that says that within certain period of time, no supply will enter this area. So those who want to survive must leave, otherwise they will have to face a real terrible possible starvation.
But over the past 13 months, it does seem as if the Israeli authorities have used food as a weapon of war in Gaza.
That's simply not true. I thought that we should have done it, but it has not been adopted. On the contrary.
But it's been a constant debate.
There is no a debate about that. What is happening in Gaza is that Hamas sent a message as if we were preventing food from the population. And this message has arrived in Washington, in New York, in London, and other places and created some reaction, but none of them were based on any real facts. So Israel did not use this tool, although we should have.
And that was retired General Giora Eiland speaking to NewsHour's Julian Marshall there. Well, how much support is there for this idea in Israel? Let's speak to Israeli political analyst and pollster Dalia Scheindlin now. She joins us live from Tel Aviv. I mean, we heard the general there talking about possible starvation, which obviously would have an impact on civilians. What do ordinary Israelis think of all this?
Well, we should point out that ordinary Israelis have not been polled on specifically the plan. But I think there are a number of specific components. For one thing, it's true that certainly in the first number of months, polls have shown pretty harsh attitudes among Israeli Jews, in particular, the majority of Israelis, 73% who are Jews, who have been against humanitarian aid to Gaza at points, up to 60% and over. That has changed a little bit over time. Those numbers have declined somewhat, I think, as Israelis realized how harsh the situation was. But I think the real question about the general's plan is that it lays the groundwork for a permanent Israeli control, occupation, and possibly rebuilding of settlements in the wildest dreams of the far right political leaders. And that's the kind of thing that I think the Israeli public has to consider if they're going to adopt this plan, in addition to the very severe humanitarian ramifications. And there, from what we can see by related polls that ask these questions, Israelis are deeply divided over the issue. The majority of Israelis are against it. If you look only at the Jewish population, you have barely half who would support something like occupation and building settlements. But that breaks down into less than a quarter, even of the Jewish population, and less than 20% of the total population who would support the very extreme position of a reoccupation and rebuilding of settlements. Now, the general's plan won't say that's what they're doing, but combined with the leaders of the Israeli government, the current Israeli government, who are far right, ultra-nationalist, very, very ideologically, religiously driven leaders, there's no question that they would leverage that kind of a plan to advance their own designs of permanently occupying that area.
Interesting. And is it possible to know whether this latest conflict in Lebanon has had some sort of shift with the public opinion as well?
Well, I think public opinion is reflecting the fact that Israelis have not really been told by their leaders that there is any alternative other than the military escalation in Lebanon. The Israeli government has not truly made the case for diplomatic de-escalation in the north, which between Israel and Hezbollah, which would have been linked to advancing a ceasefire in Gaza. The government has not wanted to acknowledge that link.
Okay.
And so if you look at that link, the majority of Israelis prefer a hostage release deal that would entail a ceasefire in Gaza. And if somebody had made the case for them that would de-escalate the Northern Front, they may have supported it. But as
we
it
must
is,
leave it there.
We see a majority in support of Lebanon.
Dalia Scheindlin there. Sorry to cut her off. Still to come on the programme, last year the people of a small town in Kansas were shocked by a police raid on its local paper. Such a raid on a newspaper is rare in America, but it's an example of how fragile the freedom of the press can be, particularly in rural towns. We'll be hearing from the paper's editor.
I was at my home with my 98-year-old mother, simultaneously in the what was billed by the police as the biggest raid in the history of Marion County. They raided this office, my mother's home, and the home of the vice mayor, with I think it was as many as 9 police officers that came in to execute a search warrant. They were searching for a document that we had obtained from a source.
More on that story to come later this hour. And our top headline, Israeli troops and Hezbollah militants have been engaged in close combat fighting in southern Lebanon. We'll be returning to that too later this hour. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC. Now, October is considered the spooky month for many around the world ahead of Halloween on the 31st. Lots of people dress up as ghosts and zombies, which are supposed to be human beings returning from the dead. Well, for decades, zombies have featured in many films. Some are supposed to terrify us, others are a bit more comical. But where did the idea of zombies come from? A new exhibition in Paris looks at how the zombie myth extended around the world from Haiti, and it investigates a strong connection to the slave trade in Africa. Vincent Dowd has this report.
Welcome to a night of total terror.
The Quai Branly Museum in Paris looks at cultures worldwide. Its latest exhibition is all about zombies, partly about how we regard the walking undead today, influenced by films such as Night of the Living Dead, made in 1968 by George A. Romero.
They're coming to get you, Barbara.
You're ignorant.
They're coming for you, Barbara.
But the new exhibition also shows, using French and English, how the concept of the zombie moved first to Haiti from Africa and then into international popular culture. Curator Philippe Charlier.
Think about Hollywood zombies, book zombies. This is absolutely the fake one. The true one belongs to Haiti because you've got the conjunction of all the religions from sub-Saharan Africa. And second, you've got a slave territory. Only in Haiti you may find true and authentic zombies. The name zombie comes from Black Africa, from sub-Saharan Africa, especially from Democratic Republic of Congo. And zombie means ghost of a dead child. The concept moved during the slave trade because it was a spirit initially, but no corpse. Then, with a zombie in Haiti, it's a corpse without any spirit.
Cinema audiences may long have delighted in gory tales of the dead returning to life.
Not dead? Are you mad? I saw her die.
Zombie! Allez!
But the exhibition shows that zombies entered pop culture only after a horrific era in history. The trade in slaves found its focus in what is now Haiti.
Roughly how many Black African slaves came to Haiti?
Oh, millions came to Haiti. We don't have yet scientific quantification of the number of slaves.
How much of what we're looking at in this exhibition in Paris has its origins in the slave trade?
Zombies in Haiti, so the original one, are a kind of new slave. Without this slave trauma, it would not have been possible to create zombies.
And over here in this display case, we have a number of... Well, explain to me what they are, Philippe.
These are iron shackles for slaves. Many of them have been found in Haiti.
Philippe Charlier says outside Haiti, there was little cultural interest in zombies until, in 1915...
Haiti was occupied by the United States of America, and anthropologists discovered the zombie phenomenon. And it was later discovered also by Hollywood. The two main goals of this exhibition, the discovery, full discovery of what a true zombie is, and also the real voodoo culture from Haiti, which is absolutely beautiful and exceptional.
The exhibition at the Quai Branly Museum is fun, but it also shows France thinking through little understood aspects of the Atlantic slave trade and its legacy.
Scary stuff there from Vincent Dowd. Now, the Weintraub Syncopators were a talented jazz band in 1920s Berlin. It's known as a creative, hedonistic time in the German capital with a vibrant, arty scene. And the band were a favourite with audiences. But when the Nazis came to power in the 1930s, the band, most of whom were Jewish, left on tour and never returned. Now, 100 years on from their forming, a recovered painting of the band by artist Max Oppenheimer is going on show at the Jewish Museum in Berlin. I've been speaking to Olbrecht Dumlin, who's a Berlin-based music historian and author, about the band's forgotten story.
They were founded in August 1924 in Berlin-Charlottenburg as a group of amateurs, and they had great success because they introduced to the dance floor the shimmy and the Charleston and jazz rhythms, which were new at the time. They had heard symphonic jazz and Gershwin and tried to imitate this. And this was such a great success that after 2 years, then they were professional musicians and were appearing on stage with very prominent artists, including Josephine Baker and the Tiller Girls. And they were so successful because everyone could play at least seven instruments, and they were comedians. So they appeared on stage, they played. They did not only make music, but they were actors at the same time.
Oh, fantastic. I mean, this is a really interesting period in Berlin's history, isn't it? The sort late 20s, early 30s, before the Nazis came to power. And it's kind of known as being pretty wild, kind of hedonistic, you know, very creative time. Yeah. What can you tell us about it?
It was a very busy time. There were such a large number of cabarets in Berlin, and it was the starting of the sound film, where they were engaged, for example, in the film Der Blaue Engel, The Blue Angel. The Blue Angel was the start of the career of Marlene Dietrich and also of Friedrich Holländer, the composer, as a film composer. The Weintraubs appeared on stage, five of them, and interesting enough, the melodies were done by Friedrich Holländer, but the orchestration was done by Franz Waxman, another Hollywood composer, and also by a member of the band, Sidney John Kay, who ended up in Australia. And these songs of the Blue Angel are world famous, von Kopf bis Fuß auf Liebe eingestellt, zum Beispiel, for the example.
Falling in love again, never wanted to. What am I to do? I can't help it.
Of course, this is a period just before the rise of the Nazi regime, and many of the people in the band were Jewish. Tell us what happened when the Nazis came to power.
They appeared in February 1933 at the Wintergarten Cabaret, and then they saw the Reichstag burning, and they said, we cannot stay any longer. And only when they were away, they decided that they would never come back, since they were, most of them were Jewish.
Well, I mean, it must have been a very traumatic time for them. And actually, they didn't perform after the war together again, did they?
They ended up in Australia. But then they were the German members with the German passport. They were interned as enemy aliens, and not only that, but also as spies. And then the group ended up, most of the musicians continued to live in Sydney. But they had not very close contact because of the past. It's a sad story, but hopefully with my book and with the centenary, an English translation of the book is in the works.
And, of course, now this painting of the band has come back into the spotlight and is going to be shown at the Jewish Museum in Berlin. It's a beautiful painting that really does sort of encapsulate that era of Berlin. What do you hope may come out of this being back on display in the city they were from?
The Oppenheimer painting, the jazz band or Weintraub Syncopators, was done in 1927. It was quite an honor that Oppenheimer painted the Weintraubs. And the Weintraubs also used it for advertising. It's a wonderful painting, and I hope that this is the highlight of the centenary celebrations. And I hope that there will be much, much more interest for this band now, which was so famous in the 1920s.
Historian Olbrecht Dumlin speaking to me earlier. And let's take a little bit of the English version of Blue Angel to the news, which is next. Welcome back to NewsHour. Coming up in a moment, we'll be hearing a report from our Middle East correspondent in southern Lebanon. But before that, here's a reunion worth waiting 57 years for. A husband and wife in Australia have been reunited with the long-lost footage of their wedding in Scotland after it was found by chance decades later. Rebecca Wood has the story.
As a smiling bride walks down the church steps, new husband proudly on her arm, confetti is flung into the air, and a small page boy and flower girl gather by their sides. The couple in question are 20-year-old Aileen and Bill Turnbull in Aberdeen, Scotland. The date is August 1967, and somewhat ahead of their time, they got their wedding day filmed, a way of preserving their memories forever. Or was it?
After the wedding, we wanted to see it. Bill borrowed a projector from a guy at his work. So we were able to see it just that one time. And then after that, it disappeared. And we did try and ring this guy a couple of times, but we could, you know, we didn't have any luck. We couldn't get it. So that was it.
Aileen and Bill went on to have three children, and they later moved to the other side of the world, to Australia. The film was never found, and they thought no more of it, until 57 years later, when Aileen saw her picture online.
Just all of a sudden, you know, I saw this photograph, and Bill was sitting with me at the time when it came up, and I thought, oh my goodness, here's my wedding photograph. And then when I read it, and it said, does anyone know this couple? And I knew right away, I thought, this is from our wedding video.
Back in Aberdeen, it was Terry Cheen who'd posted the picture on social media. He stumbled across the wedding video after having his own film reels transferred onto DVD. It turns out his uncle was Bill's colleague who'd lent him the projector.
I took a screenshot and I posted it on a Facebook webpage. Can anybody tell me who this is? And there was no response for 5 months. And then all of a sudden, one night, there's a lady called Aileen. Hi, this is me.
So, after nearly 60 years, and thanks to Terry's quest to reunite the film with its mystery owner, Aileen and Bill once again get to see their wedding day come to life before their very eyes.
I just couldn't believe it. What struck me was the fact that it wasn't just like a photograph. I could see my parents, Bill's grandmother and grandfather. It was just unbelievable.
It's quite amazing to think that the page boy, he's 60.
He's 61.
And the page girl's 60.
What made me even more emotional is just the response that I've got from everyone. People wishing us well, and I keep saying to Bill, you know, all these people, we don't know them. And yet they're sending us all these good wishes, and it's just been overwhelming, really.
Aileen Turnbull, ending that report by Rebecca Wood, reunited with their wedding video and pictures 57 years on. You're listening to NewsHour live from the BBC. I'm Rebecca Kesby. More now from the Middle East. Israel's attacks on Lebanon have been continuing overnight. According to Lebanon's health ministry, at least 15 people have been killed by Israeli airstrikes on different parts of the country. The Israeli military, or IDF, says Hezbollah militants fired more than 300 projectiles into Israel on Saturday. Well, it has ordered the evacuation of more villages in southern Lebanon, telling residents to move north. It's also told the United Nations mission in Lebanon to move to safer areas further north. Israel denies accusations that it's deliberately targeting UN buildings along the 2006 ceasefire line with Lebanon. And to press that message home, the IDF has taken international journalists to an undisclosed location across the border for the first time. Our Middle East correspondent Lucy Williamson was among them. Their access was restricted, and this report, but not its editorial content, has been checked for military security.
We drove along the old ceasefire line dividing Israel from Lebanon, moving fast under the threat of Hezbollah attack, the rest of the army convoy lost in clouds of yellow dust behind us.
We just crossed into southern Lebanon.
with the Israeli army. It's still a very unpredictable situation here. Regular threats from Hezbollah forces.
Israel's army broke through this border less than 2 weeks ago. Now they're taking us in to show us one of the villages under their control, a couple of miles into Lebanese territory. The area, still not clear of Hezbollah fighters.
We are literally in an area which still haven't been neutralized. Right? It's a war zone with all the implications you can hear in the background.
The Divisional Chief of Staff, Colonel Roy Russo, showed us a storage room he said was used as a base by Hezbollah.
And here they're morphing from civilians into combatants operators. So you have AK-47s, you have personal gear, you have anti-tank missiles, you saw one of the launchers over there, and the unit becomes an effective combat unit here. All this gear is designed to maneuver into the Israeli side and conduct operation on the Israeli side. This is not defensive, but this is called counterattack.
Israel says these are limited, targeted raids. Geographically, perhaps, militarily, less so. Many of the buildings we saw had been demolished, reduced to rubble. Two tanks sit in a clearing nearby.
They want to do the 7th of October here, in the northern border.
The army told us they'd found dozens of booby-trapped houses here and demolished them. We only have their account of what happened here and were restricted in where we could go. They also showed us the weapons they said they'd found here, including sophisticated anti-tank missiles, shoulder-launched rockets and night scopes. Some of them brand new, still packed into boxes. Preparations for a cross-border attack into Israel, the army said.
This is, I can say, two times more or three times more than Gaza in the weapons that this village contains.
This, Colonel Malka told me, is why the army was here, not for occupation.
We don't want to hold these places. We want to clean them out from all the weapons and the ammunition. That's what we want. After that, we are expecting that the people will come back and understand that peace is better to them and terrorists controlling on them is a bad thing. But I leave it to the diplomat to solve. This is my guys. This is my guys fighting on the Kasbah.
There's been bursts of small arms fire and artillery very close by. He says his forces are fighting Hezbollah 500 metres away.
Let's go on. Let's go. Yeah. Let's go on, guys.
The fighting gets closer. We're told to leave fast. Hezbollah may have pulled its fighters back from this border, but it hasn't disappeared from the fight. And Israel's conflict with Iran hangs over it. Israeli forces have delivered some small successes along this frontier, but this is not a border war. It's a regional one, playing out along a border.
Go. Our correspondent Lucy Williamson with that report. Well, many civilians fleeing southern Lebanon have been given temporary shelter in schools further north of the country. And you may remember earlier this week on NewsHour, we spoke to Imad Al-Ashkar, who's Lebanon's director of the Ministry for Education. But we also wanted to hear from a teacher on the ground. So through the Ministry of Education, we were put in touch with Manel Hadafi, and she's the school director of Kamal Jomblat Official School. It's in the Mount Lebanon area. She herself is from the Druze community, and she told us what had been happening at her school.
All of the public schools in Lebanon are turned into shelters for displaced people. The situation is going worse and worse because, you know, there is no safe place in Lebanon. Every day, every moment, every minute, there is a new place that they are bombed by the crazy Israel army. They are bombing civilian people and civilian buildings also. So for the public schools, because some of the private schools are opened, but the public schools are all closed and turned into shelters. And we are working with the Education International, which is based in Brussels, for me as an elected executive member board for the Education International to help those schools to survive for giving the refugees in the schools or providing them the base needs that they want to continue.
So you've been sort of brought in to the relief effort for the displaced people. So, I mean, have you heard many bombs going off in your area?
We have one bomb 2 weeks ago. My region is a safe area. Because of that, we have more than 13,000 displaced people in my region, from the students, from the teachers, and from the people. So I asked the students, the parents, all of them, they said, we don't want the war. We want to go back to our home. And the students, they are so cute. They said, we miss our teachers and we miss our schools and we want to go back.
How do you explain what's going on to the children?
The children, they are smarter than us, because when I asked him why you are here, he said because it's of war, because of Israel army, because they are crazy. All of the students, all of the kids, they know everything and they are watching, unfortunately, everything on the social media and on the TV.
There are people in Lebanon who do blame Hezbollah for getting the country into this conflict, because they did fire rockets at Israel after October the 7th.
I understand. For the students and for the people who is displaced in my region, they didn't say that. And for me also, I didn't say that. What can I say? That we want to live in our country in a peaceful life. We want to stay in our country. So all of the people, you are saying that maybe a group of people are blaming. I'm not blaming anybody. I know that Israel is bombing civilian peoples. They are lying all of the world. They are lying that they are bombing only Hezbollah. No, they are bombing all of the civilian peoples. They are bombing kids. They are bombing women. They are bombing everywhere.
And in terms of the relief effort, are you getting much help from what's left of the Lebanese government in terms of helping to get you supplies to help the displaced people?
We have, before the economic crisis in our country, so we are in a lack for maybe good strategies for like this situation, like war or emergency situation. But for the Ministry of Education that is caring for the schools, public schools that are the shelters, they are doing their best. Unfortunately, political issues are affecting everything. Then COVID-19, then the economic crisis, and now the war. We are in a lack for the quality of education.
And how might that affect the country in the future?
For us as a Lebanese people, we are adapt for that, because every 10 years in this country, something will come, destroy our country, and then we will go up again, and then we will rebuild our country, and then we will go up, and then we can breathe.
Manal Hadafi, the school director of Kamal John Blatt Official School in the Mount Lebanon area there. Let's move on to the US election. There's less than a month to go now, and with the polls still so tight, both campaign teams know that every vote counts, particularly those in crucial swing states, as we keep hearing. Both sides have made overtures to the different communities, the so-called female vote, the white Midwestern male vote, and of course the Latino vote, particularly in the past few days. Both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump have been hoping to win over support with Hispanic communities in Nevada. They've both been in Las Vegas. So what did the voters make of it all? Let's speak to Democratic pollster Aileen Cardona-Arroyo of Hart Research Associates. Thanks for coming on, Aileen. We often refer to communities as sort of voting blocks. Is that still the case with Hispanic voters?
Thank you for having me. I mean, Latino voters are an incredibly diverse and complicated voting group, in that I like to refer to them less as a Latino vote and more as a Latino voters, because there are so many differences, geographic differences, national origin differences that do have an impact in voting behavior and attitudes.
And which way is it going this year? Because historically, the Democratic Party has enjoyed a lot of votes from this community, but possibly not so much anymore.
Well, there's two things that remain that are true and will be true this November, is that, you know, Harris will win the majority of Latino voters across the country. That is that's to be expected, and that's what we will see in November. But there is no doubt that there has been some loss of democratic margins among some segments of Latino voters, especially Latino men and Latino men and non-college educated Latino men and younger Latino men, where we have seen some erosion in recent cycles in democratic margins.
And why is that? What are the main issues?
Well, I think what we're seeing right now with Latino voters and what we're seeing right now really with American voters is a lot of concerns for the cost of living and the economy. And this is an area where they, although Harris, you know, gets an advantage with Latino voters on virtually most issues and in areas, they do give Trump an advantage when it comes to the cost of living and the economy. And we're seeing that reflected in the polls.
And briefly, just in terms of Nevada, what impact would the Latino vote have there in the upcoming elections, do you think?
Well, I mean, as you saw, Trump and Harris are making outreach to Latino voters in Nevada and other swing states. And I think the Harris campaign is very, very smart because they're leading with clear economic plans. And the contrast between how both campaigns are reaching out to Latino voters could not be starker. Harris is leading with empathy, understanding, and acknowledgement that many Latino families are struggling with the cost of living. But then she also talks about a plan to uplift Latino families, where, on the other hand, Trump is leading with division, fear-mongering,
well,
and really a dire outlook for America.
His team would say he's focusing on the economy and immigration, of course, but they're not here to make that point. But our thanks to you, Aileen Cardona Arroyo of Hart Research Associates. That's a Democratic pollster there. Thank you so much for joining us live. This is Rebecca Kesby with NewsHour live from the BBC World Service. In August last year, the people of a small town in Kansas were shocked by a police raid on its local newspaper, the Marion County Record. Surveillance cameras and police body cam footage showed the newsroom being searched and the paper's 98-year-old owner distressed at the police intrusion into her home. Joan Mayer died the day after. Well, such a raid on a newspaper is very rare in America, but for other small papers across the country, it's an example of how fragile the freedom of the press can be, particularly in rural towns. The BBC's Gary O'Donoghue has been speaking to Joan Mayer's son, Eric, who is the editor and publisher of the Marion County Record.
I was at my home with my 98-year-old mother, simultaneously in the what was billed by the police as the biggest raid in the history of Marion County. They raided this office, my mother's home, and the home of the vice mayor, with I think it was as many as 9 police officers that came in to execute a search warrant. They were searching for a document that we had obtained from a source.
The police were investigating allegations of identity theft by one of the paper's reporters. But in fact, the reporter had obtained the details from a publicly available state website.
There really was no reason to search either our house, the record, or the vice mayor's house because we admitted we had the document.
Don't you touch any of that stuff.
Seen in the video, Joanne Mayer died the next day. Her son, the co-owner of the paper, says stress from this raid played a role in the death of his 98-year-old mother.
There were 7 officers in her house to seize her computer. She'd become very frustrated by this. Several times told them that she was getting so upset that she was going to have a heart attack and die, or she was going to have a stroke and die. But after the police left up there, she was disconsolate. She sat in her chair till something like 6:30 in the morning. I went in to check on her. I said, you really need to have something to eat. How about I make you some breakfast? Where do you want it? She says, I don't know. I don't feel too... and died right at that moment. And the coroner came, who had been her family physician. He said stress from the raid was a contributing factor to her death.
In August, 2 prosecutors who'd examined the case cleared the newspaper of any wrongdoing in a 124-page report.
We've had these prosecutors that have come up with this report. They've said that the raid shouldn't have happened. But you're still involved in litigation, right?
Oh, yeah. It took the prosecutors nearly 1 year to report that we had not committed a crime. Yet we kept hearing that, oh, you're under suspicion, you haven't been cleared. It turns out they were investigating what the police did.
A former Kansas police chief tied to a raid on a local newspaper last year has been charged with felony obstruction of justice.
The current acting police chief and his predecessor won't say anything. The current and previous mayor say they can't say anything either. And the county sheriff told me his lawyers told him not to say anything either.
I wanted to find out what the impact of this row had been on the local community, so I've come to the Presbyterian Church.
My name is Jeremiah Lang. I'm the pastor at Marion Presbyterian Church. This is kind of a boiling pot that had been boiling, and everybody was hoping that somebody else would turn off the gas. And I think everybody, just including myself, we all kind of contributed to adding to the heat and not turning off the gas. And
why do you think you contributed?
In a community where you have a paper that's critical of people on a local level, that tends to create defensiveness, and it also can lean into divisiveness. I think if you went around to the community, most everyone here is going to say, well, I'm for the freedom of the press. What happened for us was a breakdown in communication and relationship.
Well, I thought that was really interesting. One of the most telling things he told me was that the strength of these sorts of communities, these small communities, is that everyone knows one another. But that can also be a terrible weakness when things go wrong.
Gary O'Donoghue reporting there, and you can hear more of Gary's documentary, US Local News 2024, on the front page, front line, wherever you get your BBC podcasts. Now, the murder of a former minister in the Indian state of Maharashtra has raised security concerns in the city of Mumbai. Baba Siddiqui was killed in a drive-by shooting on Saturday night. Police have made two arrests and are still on the hunt for a third suspect. As well as politics, Mr. Siddiqui was a well-known figure in the entertainment industry and apparently had received recent death threats. For more details, I've been speaking to the BBC's Mayuresh Kunnar.
The police are saying they are still doing a preliminary investigations. They have few leads and they are working on that. What we know so far is that Baba Siddiqui, who was a known politician and who also has very deep connections in the Bollywood film industry business in Mumbai, while he was getting out of his son's office, his son is also a politician and currently the member of Maharashtra Assembly. And while he was getting from the out from the office and into his car, he was shot at by three gunmen. He was taken to a nearby hospital, but then he was declared dead in few minutes. And currently, five police teams are being formed. Right now, what we have is two of the three gunmen have been arrested.
Okay. I mean, you say that there are theories going around. Mr. Siddiqui was a big figure in the city, and there is speculation that this could be a possible contract killing. What can you tell us about his background politically, first of all?
He was a longtime member of Indian National Congress, and he himself got elected to Maharashtra Assembly for three consecutive terms. He was a very well-known figure. As far as Congress and politics is concerned, he was a face of Mumbai Congress, Mumbai being the capital of Maharashtra and also the financial capital of India.
Okay, so he was a big figure in the Congress party, but then he joined the unrelated regional National Congress Party, the NCP, which actually is part of the current governing coalition, I think, with the BJP.
Yes, it is. So Baba Siddiqui ended his long-time association with the Congress and joined NCP to be a part of ruling dispensation. And there were talks that since Maharashtra is going into an assembly election in just a few days now, Siddiqui will again contest from his own constituency.
And Mayuresh, a quick word on the security concerns after this killing, because it all happened while the city was actually under quite tight security because there's been a big festival going on over the past few days.
Yes, it is. And that's the concern. You know, Baba Siddiqui reportedly got a death threat few days back, and that was reported to police by him, and he was given vice grade security by the police. So now the question arises, if his security was beefed up, he had a vice security, still how the assailants reached him and breached the security and got him murdered? That's the main question.
The BBC's Mayuresh Kunnar there with that story breaking in India a few hours ago. That's it for this edition from us all here. Thanks for joining us.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts. Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskanda from the Global Story podcast, where we're looking at America's relationship with China. Diplomacy between the world's two largest economies remains characteristically choppy. But could the result of the U.S. presidential election unlock a calmer future? The Global Story brings you unique perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.